fellow travellers, and welcome to podcast 166. Yes, clickety click, with me, Simon Calder.
And me, Mick Webb, reclaiming my seat at the table after last week's podcast about the trans-European race to Istanbul by public transport was hijacked by Simon. Now, more of that great event in a moment, but this week our main topic is travel cliches and cliched travel. And to help us find truth and enlightenment amid the billions of effusions and pronouncements about holidays and travel, I'm delighted to welcome back Emily Thomas, Professor of Philosophy at Durham University and author of The Meaning of Travel, Philosophers Abroad. Hello again, Emily. Long time no hear.
Hello, Mick and Simon. It's a pleasure to be back.
And congratulations on your elevation. You are now officially the very first professor to speak on You Should Have Been There. I'm sure we can organise a badge for you, which I imagine you will hugely enjoy wearing around the campus at Durham University.
A badge sounds fantastic. Thanks very much.
Well, as usual, let's start by catching up with parish notices and responses to recent podcasts. And there's been plenty of activity on the New Look Twitter. On the subject of podcast 161's quest to find the perfect island, Jane Innes had this to say. I do love islands. Of the islands I've so far been to, my favourite is St Agnes, a silly island. That's with a C, I should say. Maybe the next 20 years of my life needs to involve a lot more checking out of islands. Some in the Caribbean look in need of a recce.
And we've followed up the perfect island in podcast 162 with island hopping. Here's Matt H., lovely follow-up to the Perfect Island podcast, Woohoo for Corfu again, and Folly Grandos, which I think may be the perfect island for a writing away fortnight. Thanks for that, Matt. I've not been lucky enough to go to Folly Grandos. However, I do know that it doesn't have an airport, which is generally an advantage for finding those more authentic Greek islands. And John Wall tweeted, Hi Mick and Simon, when it comes to island hopping, how about Westray and Papa Westray Islands in Orkney? I have a certificate for the shortest scheduled airline flight in the world. We could see one runway from the other.
Is that really true? That's completely mad, isn't it? I mean,
yes.
No, I'm not going to suggest, John, that you should have swum, but maybe, or canoed. But anyway, I haven't been there, so I don't know anything about it. But Emily, we must ask you, are you an island person? And if so, do you have one that deserves the accolade of perfect?
I am an island person. I actually grew up on the island of Guernsey. Which is rather wonderful as places go. And I'm going to nominate the neighbouring island of Herm, which is almost like a tiny little Caribbean island that's been picked up and dropped in the English Channel. It's gorgeous. There's no cars. There's beaches all the way around. It's really stunningly beautiful.
Oh, that's amazing. I thought Sark was the smallest of the Channel Islands, so there's one that's even smaller.
It is, yeah. Herm is even smaller. And Herm is really easy to get to from Guernsey. Sark is a little bit more of a ferry ride. But Sark is like going back in time, because it does feel like there are little villages without cars, that you feel a bit like a hobbit.
Sorry about the noises off here, by the way, everybody. I'm in a slightly crowded green room about to address the nation, and this is the only place I could get, so I'm going to have to put up with this. I'm hiding in the corner, but obviously not far enough away. Anyway, a subject that runs and runs is lame excuses given for travel delays, and here's Tim Coxon. We flew into Madrid in April. After the 25-minute taxi to the terminal, yes, I can absolutely believe that. Terminal 4 at Madrid Airport is, I think, actually probably closer to Barcelona than it is to the Spanish capital. Anyway, Tim says we waited 50 minutes for a bus to take us into the building, and a cabin crew member helpfully told us the delay was due to an air traffic control strike in France.
Well... When it comes to delays, the finger often seems to get pointed at catering. Sarah Banks said, once delayed in Charlotte, North Carolina, flying back to London Gatwick as the catering truck had driven into the plane.
That's wonderful.
There is something actually quite kind of entertaining about that, isn't it? That's great. But we've also, in previous podcasts, Emily, heard of a rat in a catering lorry, I think it was in India, escaping onto a plane and causing no end of mayhem. Though none of them quite match the anecdote that you came up with, Simon, about the reason for a Russian flight being delayed in the, I think it was in the 1990s, and because the catering crew had been arrested.
Exactly right. Anyway, one more, a bit of refreshing honesty, this time from a pilot rather than a lame excuse, brought to our attention by James Ogden. I was delayed for 3 hours at Heathrow with an engine apparently reporting an error. We eventually departed and the captain announced we thought we'd have to cancel. But in the end, the engineers turned the engine off and on again, and it's no longer reporting an error. And of course, whatever your delay excuse, we'd love to hear it. You can tweet us at youshouldhavebt or leave us a message at anchor.fm/youshouldhavebeenthere.
And apologies, Emily, for the delay to our conversation, but there is one other thing we must mention. The Lupine Travel Trans-Europe Race to Istanbul, the start of which Simon reported on last week. Simon, I think you've been trying to catch up with how this event ended.
With the most amazing finish, considering this was a journey of over, getting on for 2,000 miles by road, by public transport, mostly by train and bus across Europe, the winning margin was down to about 1 minute. What happened was that the two leading people, that was Eleanor Parker and Bram Houtenbusch, found themselves on the same bus going to Istanbul bus station. They realized they were in the lead. They realized that this was just a head-to-head race. They then ran and got the same tram to Sultanahmet Square. And unbelievably, well, Eleanor managed to find a faster route to get to the obelisk where they were meeting. That was the official end of the race, and she just made it. And I managed to catch up with her in Istanbul, feeling understandably chuffed.
I was feeling full of adrenaline, like really excited, but now I've spent a couple of days like relaxing. I'm sort of coming down a bit, like maybe feeling even like a bit bored because I've stopped moving around.
Talk us through your strategy and talk us through that incredible finish to the race.
I mean, I didn't have too much of a strategy. I was quite opportunistic. I ended up being on predominantly buses from Venice onwards, and they were just back-to-back buses. There was barely any breathing time between them. So strategy was no showers, barely any sleep or food. And then me and Bram, my competitor, we ended up on the same bus towards Istanbul. So we were both getting very stressed and anxious as it came into Istanbul. And then, had a really exciting like dash through Istanbul center to get to the park. So I think Bram took a slightly different turning at some point, which was a bit longer. So I just made it there in time.
And look, extraordinary, the fact that this came down to just seconds. You've travelled probably the route you took, maybe 2,000 miles. Tell us about the best part, which I imagine might be the finish, and the worst part.
Yeah. So other than the finish and that race, best part, I think, was coming in to Venice on the night bus and seeing Venice at like 6 a.m. before anyone was around. It was really beautiful, having like an hour's respite there. And of course, the finishing race. The worst part was being stuck in a South Serbian bus station in the early hours of the morning. So I was glad to see my competitors when they turned up, actually, there.
That's Eleanor Parker. It was very exciting. I'm quite tempted next time to enter. And from what I can understand, it's going to be going to somewhere in the Balkans. My money is actually that it could be on, it could be going to Tirana, the Albanian capital, possibly Pristina in Kosovo. But I think I might be on for that particular exciting journey. But obviously, Eleanor and Bram, very, very formidable competitors. Does it tempt you at all, Emily?
It really does. It sounds wonderful, actually.
Good. Well, I will see you, and that maybe we can all go on it.
But maybe we should actually get on to the topic of the day, which is the role of the good old cliche when we're talking about or writing about travel. You know the kind of thing, winding streets, lands of contrast, golden sunsets, rugged mountains, turquoise water, friendly people, blah, blah, stunning panoramic views, pine-clad hillsides, powdery beaches, buildings huddling around cobbled squares. Anyway, I could go on, but I don't think it's a very good idea. So maybe we should start, Emily, by asking what a cliche actually is and why there's so much of it about in travel.
So the word cliche actually comes from the sound that a French printing press used to make. When the mechanism was printing the same thing time after time after time. Right, so this is what it literally means. Cliche, it's something that is run of the mill.
That is so clever.
Overworn. And then, of course, that leads to the notion of a cliche as something that is outworn and run of the mill. Yeah, and as for why there's so many cliches in travel, I've been thinking hard about that. I think part of the reason is that travel is a kind of non-fiction writing that nonetheless uses lots of fictional devices. You know, there's buckets of metaphors and similes, The plots of travel writing really often resemble fictional plots. And then as soon as you have those sorts of descriptive literary devices, you open the door to cliches. Why travel is so particularly prone to it, I think, is because when we write about our travels, we're frequently trying to explain the unfamiliar. But that's really hard to do, because if you're genuinely encountering something that you've never seen before and you know that your readers have never encountered before, you can't describe it in its own terms. But what travel writers end up doing is attaching the unfamiliar to the familiar. Right? So things like you find vintage travel writing describing rhino skin like being of coach leather, for example. And these expressions get used and reused, and that's how we end up with so many cliches. I suspect a further problem is that the way we approach the world is often influenced by society. So, for example, before the 17th century, people thought that mountains were ugly. So everybody's using the same kinds of descriptions, you know, warts, protuberances, spots upon the earth. But then once everyone begins to think, oh no, mountains are actually really beautiful, then everyone is describing them as divine, cathedral, godlike. And all of this leads to a lack of originality, to cliche.
And so that sounds to me very much like group travel think, which I think may actually be a phrase that you have copyrighted. but I guess maybe there's nothing wrong with cliches if it is simply conveying, as you say, conveying the unfamiliar using familiar terms. And if you've never been to Colombia or Ecuador, you might find it quite helpful to know that both of them describe themselves as a country of contrasts, for example.
So you might think that's true, but a lot of writers have really railed against cliche, and they've gone so far as to say that when you use cliche, you're actually no longer communicating in a useful way. So one thing people think is wrong with cliches is that it leads to lazy writing, that it's a cliche is a labor-saving device, and you're getting something on the cheap. But The issue then is that people are no longer really reading the cliche, but that somehow your brain skates over what the cliche is saying. And so George Orwell, he's one of the famous writers who says this. He reckons that cliches can mislead, that they are a huge dump of worn out metaphors which have lost all evocative power. And because they've lost all evocative power, they're no longer communicating what the writers want to communicate.
Ah, well, that's interesting. But I was looking at some online holiday brochures for places like Greece and the Caribbean, just to see whether actually, if you looked at the descriptions, you could actually tell which was which. And of course, you couldn't, generally speaking. But I came upon one, what was actually quite a creative description of mountains, which described the mountains, I think it was in Greece, as sky tickling. And instead of thinking that's a brilliant and creative way of dealing with the usual kind of rugged and et cetera, et cetera, I actually thought how utterly ridiculous. I'm not really quite sure now where I stand on any of this at all.
I like that. I mean, the problem with travel is, and we are, what we value in most writing in Western society is being new and innovative and inventive. And that with travel writing, we're often revisiting destinations that have been visited so many times before. It's really hard to be new and inventive with them. And then that leads to somewhat ridiculous descriptions like sky tickling.
Do you like that or not?
I really do, actually, yeah. But perhaps I like it because it's somewhat absurd rather than because it really conveys something.
No, fair play, I suppose. I wondered whether actually, because people, we all, it's not just writing about travel, but we all like to talk about travel. And I mean, classically, you know, when you're having your hair cut, hairdresser, the first thing they ask is, first thing they ask is, how would you like your hair done? And the second thing is, have you been anywhere interesting on holiday lately? And so you have to kind of try and come up with something interesting to say rather than, oh, I've just been to Benidorm or whatever. And I found that what Dr. Johnson had to say about most of our attempts to describe our travels was rather chastening, as you might well expect. So this comes from 1760, and he's really talking, railing against travel writing. I think it could be travel talking as well. He says, the greater part of travellers tell nothing because their method of travelling supplies them with nothing to be told. He that enters a town at night and surveys it in the morning and then hastens away to another place. Simon, this is like one of your 24 hours in or whatever. And guesses at the manners,
which itself is a cliche.
Guesses at the manners of the inhabitants by the entertainment which his inn afforded him, may please himself for a time with a hasty change of scenes and a confused remembrance of palaces and churches. He may gratify his eye with a variety of landscapes and regale his palate with a succession of vintages. But let him be contented to please himself without endeavouring to disturb others.
That is absolutely brilliant. But look, we must each have our own favourite or least, most despised cliches. Shall I start?
Please.
Okay.
Do.
Well, anything. And I don't do so much copy editing at The Independent these days, but when I did, anybody who wrote that anywhere was a mecca for anything, that was spiked immediately. But it happens all the time. If you, for example, search online for Lonely Planet, a mecca for drinkers, you will be told to go to that modernist mecca of Palm Springs. I think Mecca should only be used in the context of the holiest place in Islam. So that's my start. What about you, Emily?
I like the way that towns are often described in the same way. So you have things like the harbours are always seedy. The pubs are always dark and dingy. The rooftops are always glint in the morning sun. I find these things are applied to 100,000 towns.
Do you try, when you're describing things, particularly in writing, do you actually go the extra mile to never say those things, or do you sometimes just can't resist it?
I try really hard. I've read far too many books on writing, all of which, you know, abjure you from using cliches, or if you're going to use cliches, to try and do something clever with them. And I've just read too many of those pieces of advice to allow myself to use them. And maybe that's sad. I mean, Terry Pratchett, I think, said that cliches are the nuts and bolts of conversation. So maybe we shouldn't be disallowing all of them.
With pausing only to perhaps hint to Mick that he might get a yellow card if he carries on in this fashion after going the extra mile.
Well, that wasn't a travel cliche, wasn't it? As applied to...
You try going the extra mile.
Guilty as charged. Yeah.
A cliche that I do find deeply irritating is people saying, "I'm not a tourist, I'm a traveller." I cannot stand that. Yes. I just think we are obviously tourists, unless you're actually living somewhere and really, you know, making yourself part of a community. But saying things like this,
Yes, we're all tourists. But actually, I think some companies have actually said we will take you somewhere. And here we are. Yes, Nomad's World: How to Be a Traveller, Not a Tourist. So it's all online if you want it. But I'm absolutely 100% behind you on that. Yes, thank you.
yeah, not good.
What about destinations that are actually cliched? And while we're at it, let's have a go at the bucket list. But places that are Instagrammable, I would say, therefore instantly forgettable. And the traveller becomes the focus, not the place, certainly not the local people. What do you think?
That certainly seems to be something that's happening now. There are some destinations that are so popular, so visited, and it's not worth putting a photograph of the destination online because it would just join a million other photographs. And so what you end up with, as you say, is the traveller in the foreground. And it's really about the traveller rather than the destination.
Should we name and shame some? I'd say Marbs, Marbella. what do you think? Mick, Emily?
All over Italy, I think that's been going on since the 17th century, but Instagram is going alive and well with all these major tourist sites.
I think Bruges is where I went in the depths of winter is kind of has got to that sort of point now, hasn't it? I mean, obviously anything that has a cruise liner visiting it on a weekly or twice weekly basis, which even Bruges does, which surprised me rather, seeing as it's not that close to the sea really. But I mean, it is marvelous, and I was surprised that even in the depths of a really horrible cold January wintry day, there were people queuing up to take photos at one of the places that was said to be the most photogenic spot in Bruges, which is full of photogenic spots, I might say, even.
It's something that I've noticed in hotels of late is that they sometimes prepare little Instagram places, like photogenic areas of a hotel where people can stand and take their photos with a nice view. This is something that's now quite consciously prepared, and that feels very new. What is sad, I think, with these highly over-visited destinations is that there are so many other parts of the world that aren't well-visited at all, that are just stunning. And it would be nice to have a bit more variety in what we see on Instagram.
Couldn't agree more with that. And luckily, to help you find them, Emily, there is an actual cliche, which is that X is the new Y. So Krakow is the new Prague. Tallinn is the new Krakow, and so on. There we are.
Does it come round in a circle till eventually London is the new London? I wonder if that can happen. Yes. But I wanted to ask you, Emily, whether cliches just reflect how we see the world, or whether they can actually affect it in some way.
There's been a lot of research on this, and it's shown that cliches can absolutely affect how we see the world. Sometimes it can do so in ways that seem innocuous, maybe even funny. For example, when it comes to cultural stereotypes among Western Europeans, lots of people have argued that these cliches about national identities exist and that they actually affect how people interact with each other. And I'm going to read you an example from 1625, which argues, "There is nothing more subject to admiration than the diversity of the natural dispositions and nations. Pride and ambition in the Spaniard, levity in the French, dangerous dissimulation in the Italian, drunkenness in the Dutch, falsehood in the Irish, and gluttony in the English." So, I mean, I think these things seem quite amusing now. But of course, that's not the case with other national stereotypes or cliches. You know, we have some really dangerous and unpleasant cliches about other countries. For example, you know, South Americans are said to be corrupt, and Africans are said to be lazy. And these kinds of cliches, unfortunately, do affect the way that we encounter people. And for that reason, they seem really bad. They seem like something that we should strongly be trying to eradicate.
I think the best antidote to that is probably Mark Twain, who I don't think ever uttered a cliche, but he of course said, "Travel is fatal to prejudice, bigotry and narrow-mindedness, and many of our people need it sorely on these accounts."
Mark Twain is wonderful. I support that wholeheartedly. Another way, and I find this fascinating, but I think also true, so some people, including Gustave Flaubert, have argued that when we view the world and we are well-sourced in cliches about it, it actually affects the way our senses experience it. So you asked before about whether when I'm travel writing, I'm trying to avoid cliche. The idea is that you have to set aside the cliches, because if you don't, you will be physically experiencing the world in the cliched way. And that's hard to do, I think. You're trying to really approach the world as it is in itself, rather than through this lens of sort of societal stereotypes and cliches.
Well, I think that's a very good place to end, not least, because as they literally say time and time again, that's all we've got time for this week. It's certainly all I've got time for this week. But Professor, it has been an absolute joy to talk to you about the subject of cliches. We welcome, of course, anybody's offers of their favourite or least favourite travel cliche. You can tweet it to @youshouldhavebt or leave us an audio message, anchor.fm/youshouldhavebeenthere. But for now, Emily Thomas, Professor in Philosophy at Durham University, author of The Meaning of Travel, Philosophers Abroad, and soon to be proud wearer of a You Should Have Been There badge. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's been a pleasure.
We will be back next week. But for now, from me, Simon Calder.
And me, Mick Webb. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.